Welcome to On the Middle East, Al Monitor's podcast on the big stories in the region. My name is Ambrin Zaman, and I am Al Monitor's chief correspondent based in London. This month marks the 13th anniversary of the Syrian Revolution, and my guest today is Fabrice Ballanche, a leading expert on Syria at France's Lyon 2 University. Fabrice has published yet another book on Syria titled The Lessons of the Syrian Crisis. Fabrice's predictions on Syria have often proved to be sadly true, and in this book Fabrice contends that a Eurasian axis comprising Russia, Iran and China have gained the upper hand in the Levant and is increasing its influence in the Gulf now at the expense of the United States and other Western powers. Welcome back to On the Middle East, Fabrice. It's a pleasure to have you with us here today.
Hi, thank you.
So you've just published this really impressive book called Les Leçons de la Crise Syrienne, The Lessons of the Syrian Crisis, and its publication coincides, in fact, with the 12th anniversary of
13.
The 13th anniversary of the Syrian Revolution. And in it, you make a very bold assertion. You say that the Eurasian axis comprising of Russia, Iran, and China have won in pretty much in the Middle East, you seem to say, and that this began with Syria. Can you explain this to our audience? What exactly do you mean?
Yes, so today the world is divided between two blocks as during the Cold War. Where on one side the West, does it mean Western Europe and North America, US? And on the other side, you have a new bloc created by the alliance between Iran, Russia, and China, that I call the Eurasian axis. And what is interesting, it's that this Eurasian axis born in Syria during the civil war, because Syria create a break in the international relation. But does it mean it's the end of the domination of 25 years of the West on the world since the fall of Soviet Union? The West wanted to change the regime in Syria, as they have done for Gaddafi in Libya, but they haven't succeeded because Russia, Iran, and China behind was opposed to the regime change in Syria. So you had this bloody infighting in Syria, who was a proxy war between the West and the Eurasian axis. The beginning of the uprising was local for local reason, the dictator, yes, but very quickly you had external actors who entered in the war, and in front of the West and willing to change Bashar al-Assad, you have the willing of Putin and the Iranian to keep Bashar al-Assad. And in Syria, we have seen creation of this alliance between Russia and Iran. It was not so clear at the beginning, because if we watch the history, Russia and Iran were enemies during centuries. And at the beginning in the West, nobody believed that it could be a strong alliance on long term. And at the beginning of the conflict, we try to find in the narrative of Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and the Iranian signal of differences. The Russian don't want Assad, the Iranian want Assad, etc. It was bullshit. It was theater. The alliance was very strong, and not just for Syria. It was an alliance for Middle East. And then, of course, you have China who dream about revenge against the West, as Russia, as Iran, and they created this alliance to reduce the influence of the West on Middle East and on the world, and it's quite working, because we have many examples, as Ukraine, as Libya, as Mali, where it's working.
Well, one might disagree with you when it comes to Ukraine, because the war is ongoing and the end is, not in sight anytime soon, and nor is the victor. But let me first ask you, okay, the Eurasian Axis won in Syria, but what is Syria in fact? What kind of a prize is Syria? We're talking about a broken country, as you describe so eloquently in your book, a country where you have the American troops to the northeast, the Turks to the north, the jihadis in Idlib, and then the rest with, but he doesn't have control of the oil, of the water resources, of the rich agricultural lands, which are all under a Kurdish control with US backing. So what is the prize?
What's Syria today? It's a divided country, occupied country with Russian forces, American forces, Iranian forces. Assad control two-thirds of the co territory. The oil, as you tell, is under the control of the Kurds, and it's a big problem for the regime. But it's sustainable for Assad because he has support from Russian and Iranian. And we have to also to change the scale. Syria belong today that we to the Iranian axis. Lebanon, Syria, Iraq are mostly under the control of the Iranian through proxies. The American presence is very weak in Syria and Iraq. The Iraqi government ask for the departure of the American troops. And if you have no more troops in Iraq, you will not have any more troops in Syria. And it will be very easy for the Shia militia, the Syrian regime, to retake northeastern Syria. You will just have the north, Idlib, Kobane, the northern belt, under the control of the Turks, because it's a deal between Turkey and Russia and Iran how to share Syria, where you will have 6, 7 million of Syrian protected by Turkey. Mostly Arab Sunni. And for the regime, it's also a condition of survival because he cannot reintegrate these 6, 7 million of people under his control because today he has probably 11, 12 million of people under his control, mostly loyal to him. But if he reintegrates these 8 million of Sunni, it will destroy the balance of power. And I think that we will have Syria divided at least in two parts, regime on the south and Turkish proxies on the north. And why not a Republic of Northern Syria like we have in the Republic of Northern Cyprus under the control of the Turk in the future? The problem it's for the Kurds, but because there is it's difficult to imagine a Kurdish state without Western protection.
Well, that's a pretty dire prediction right there. A northern Syria a la Cyprus. Cyprus is still a lot better off in many ways. And for Turkey, the fact that these are ethnic Turks living there makes it much more acceptable. Whereas in Turkey, there's a lot of hostility towards the Syrian Arabs, and there would be very little appetite to finance, to subsidize northern Syria in the way that northern Cyprus is subsidized. But looking again more broadly at this victory of the Eurasian Axis, as you put it, what the West is currently trying to do, it would seem then that by promoting the Abraham Accords on the one hand, and trying to get Saudi Arabia on its side and to work with Israel, they are trying to sort of push back against this. Is that right? Would you agree with that assessment? And that's what we're seeing play out currently. And we see Iran pushing back by escalating its attacks in the Red Sea, against US military there, at the same time against US bases in Iraq and in Syria. Is that a fair description of what's going on?
Yes, well, the Abraham Agreement is tentative of US to make peace between countries and Israel. And for the Arab countries like Emirates, it's important to get some technology from Israel, like the Iron Dome to be protected against Iranian missile coming from Iran, but moreover coming from Yemen, because the Yemeni Houthi have missile from Iran and can destroy Dubai, can send missile on Riyadh, and it's a very huge the Gulf countries. That's why at the end, Saudi Arabia made this deal with the Iranian under the supervision of China. They have new diplomatic relation, but the deal was the Houthi stop to bomb, to strike Saudi Arabia, and in exchange, Saudi stopped to support the Sunni in Lebanon, in Syria, and in Iraq, and they reintegrate also Bashar al-Assad in the Arab League, as we have seen in last May in Jeddah conference. So there is a temptation of confrontation. The West tried to resist, but for the West, I think that Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq, they think that it's not so important and it's already lost. The important is to concentrate the force on Dubai, on Qatar, on Saudi, where there is money, where there is market. And Iraq, Syria, there is just bad things, bad problems. And they don't want to invest so much in this area, and probably they decide to let this area to the Iranians and the Russians. So, and but what is very difficult for the West today is to see some former allies, some allies like Saudi Arabia and Turkey, that they are moving on the Eurasian axis. Turkey made a deal with the Russian in because Erdogan was upset with the American support to the Kurds, and the Saudi Arabia probably don't want to be anymore under the control of US, don't want to respect anymore the Quincy Agreement. In 2022, when Mr. Joe Biden came to Saudi Arabia to ask to Mohammed bin Salman, could you please increase the oil production because with the sanction on Russia, oil price is very high and we need oil for Europe, etc. Mohammed Salman tell no, sorry, I don't want to increase the production and to reduce the price. And by the contrary, he reduced the production and the price of oil are still high. What's happened in Syria? There's a demonstration of the Russian hard power. Also, the threat on Saudi Arabia, if you don't deal with us, but does it mean with Putin, the oil price, we could destroy you through Yemen with Shia militia. So you have to change your alliance, and it's working. So we have, in appearance, the illusion that with Abraham agreement, with the strike on Yemen from the boat from in the Red Sea, that we can prevent the Eurasian axis to control Middle East. But when I see the situation, I'm not sure. And also because underground, the Iranian are stronger than us. When you visit Syria, Iraq, you see how they control the field. Instead, the French, the American are in bunker. They are afraid to move outside the embassy because it's a bunker, a military base because it's a bunker. And around the base, you have full of Shia militia. No, you have hundreds of thousands of Shia militia who are controlling the Levant. And how many proxies the West still have in the area? The Syrian Democratic Forces, two-thirds are Arabs, one-third is Kurds. And in case of Turkish attacks, Kurds will alone because the Arabs will not support the Syrian Democratic Forces. They will stay at home. 19, when you had the first attacks against the Syrian Democratic Forces. So I know the West is weak, and especially also because you have this trouble in Washington with probably the election of Trump. Arab countries, Arab leader need to have a clear strategy, a clear vision on the future. And with what's happened in Washington, it's not clear. It's more clear on the Putin side or in Peking side because it's dictator.
So they are more reliable allies, more predictable allies. And you used the term the Levant. I guess then what you're really saying is that the Eurasian axis has prevailed specifically in the Levant, not the Gulf, but the Levant.
Yes, is stronger in Levant, Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq, but is gaining influence too, is winning influence too in
In the
Gulf
Gulf.
country, especially in Saudi Arabia, because you have this willing of Mohammed bin Salman to be a regional power, and also because Mohammed bin Salman is upset about the American policy in Yemen. In 2017, Mohammed bin Salman, Saudi Arabia, wanted to destroy northern Yemen by embargo, by strike, and US didn't accept this genocide because he wanted to do a genocide against the Houthi. So they haven't given the weapon, the green line to the Saudi to do that. Then you had the victory in northern Yemen of the Houthi. And now you have a pro-Iranian statelet in northern Yemen with direct threat on Saudi Arabia, on the Mohammed bin Salman Vision 2013. And that's why he's very upset with US. And now he told you, I have no choice. I have to deal with the Iranian, I have to deal with the Russian because they have leverage against me. And you were not able to protect me. So I have to find an agreement with the Russian and the Iranian because I have no more confidence on the US.
Well, when you look at the map, of course, the one country that does seem in a position to check, if not reduce, Iranian influence is Turkey, right? And now we're seeing a sort of reset of sorts between the United States and Turkey, whereby the US has finally agreed to sell these F-16s to Turkey. A clear effort to sort of improve ties. Do you see that going anywhere? Do you think Turkey is seeking to position itself as a counterbalance to Iran, as some analysts claim? Or do you think, on the contrary, Turkey will just s seek its own interests and, have relations with Iran, with Russia, with the US, and act more independently?
Yes, Turkey is coming to this neo-Ottomanism policy. That's, does it mean they want to have the same importance than at the time of the Ottoman Empire, not to annex new territory, but to get influence on the Arab world, on Balkan, and for that they can play on the both side, on the Russia-Iranian side and on the Western side, and we have the hope in the West that Turkey a day will come back to the NATO house, to the Western house, if there is a new election, AKP lost the power, etc. Me, I'm not that it will happen. I do the comparison often between Erdogan and Mussolini. Mussolini take the power in 1924. He started to put in jail all the opponents, socialists, communists, democrats, etc. So to install his dictator like Erdogan. But the French and the Brit was afraid to see Mussolini moving on the German side, on the Hitler side. So they gave a lot of things to Mussolini. They gave him Ethiopia, they gave him to Libya, the Fezzan. They closed their eyes when Mussolini put in jail the democrats. And at the end, when he get what he wanted, what he need from the West, he moved to Hitler's side because as dictator, he has more interest to be with Hitler than with France and Great Britain. I think that on medium term, Turkey is the same thing. Erdogan cannot lose anymore the election because it's a dictator. He controls the media, he controls the country, and he has more interest to work with the Iranian and with the Russian to share Middle East, to share Africa. As we see, you have the Russian in Mali, in Niger, instead of France, but you have also the Turkish society, who are very strong now in Africa. And if we take the example of Libya, today Libya, it's a protectorate, it's a Russia-Turkish protectorate, and they have divided the country between the both.
It's interesting that you talk about Africa, because recently the US ambassador to Ankara, Jeff Flake, he's a political appointee, not a foreign service officer, so maybe his understanding of foreign policy may not be as nuanced, but he claimed in an essay that he was almost saying that Turkey represents US Western interests in Africa, and that the West and Turkey can work together, when in fact we know that Turkey and France, your country, are sort of in some kind of quiet competition there. So it's much more nuanced, complex, as you say. Today is the Kurdish New Year, March 21st, the Nowruz. So I will end with a question about the Kurds. You seem to be suggesting that the US presence, military presence in Iraq and Syria is, you know, going to end at some point. So if that's the case, where does that leave the Kurds in Iraq and in Syria?
If the US leave Syria, it's finished for the Kurdish state-led local administration. And we will see from the north Turkish proxies or the Turkish army to come in the area and to create this Arab belt for IDPs, or also to send back some refugees in Syria. On the south, we will see the Shia militia and the regime who will retake Raqqa, the reserve, and there is no place anymore for the Kurds. So I think that many of them will fled to Iraq, as we have seen after the fall of Afrin in 2000, when Turkey took Afrin. Most of the Kurdish population went to east, to Kamishli, to Hasake, could not stay under Turkish control. Some of them have been directly to Iraq, and from Iraq they tried to move to Germany, to Europe, where they have a connection. So there is still 1 million of Kurds on northeast Syria, and I think that most of them will immigrate, because also the Turkish plan is to destroy the Kurdish settlement, because they think that the Kurdish settlement, Kurdish population, could be PKK, so a threat for Turkey. So it's better to make an ethnic cleansing. Then in Iraq, bon, you have the Kurdish government with a territory. So it's the Kurdish population is stronger. You have probably 7 million of people. You have temptation at the time of Saddam Hussein to expel the Kurds and to kill all the Kurds. I don't think that today it's possible. And the Kurdish government in Iraq is strong with its army. But also, the relations with Baghdad are very sensitive, very difficult. Baghdad don't want to let any more autonomy and freedom to the Kurds. I would not be surprised to see another scenario like in 2017, after the referendum where the Shia militia took Kirkuk. But once the Baghdad, it's to take the Turkish border, for instance, and Syrian border, Feshrabur, Ibrahim Khalil, to cut the way for the Kurds to export their oil to Turkey and then Mediterranean, or to import goods from outside. It's a possibility, because
you know
Kurds...
what you've just said to me has you know sort of turned on a light bulb as in my brain. It's when we look at these recent threats by Turkey to, you know, mount a massive campaign against the PKK, perhaps that's almost cover for sending in more troops to protect Iraqi Kurdistan, especially the part that's governed by the KDP, which is Turkey's strongest ally. Turkey would have no interest in seeing a beefed up Iraqi troop presence along its border, or certainly not the Iraqi government forces taking control of that border. So what you've said is very, Yeah, very interesting. Fabrice, I could go on forever. I want to remind our audience that you just published this excellent book, Les Leçons de la crise syrienne, and I very much hope that it will be translated into English. Thank you so much for joining us here today. A happy Kurdish New Year to you.
You
And
too,
I
happy
hope to
New
have you
Year.
on our program again. Merci beaucoup, Fabrice.
Merci.
I thought that was a really illuminating conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Thanks for tuning in, and hope to be back soon with another interesting guest on the Middle East. Goodbye.